From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, why some television is so good and some is so bad. Carl Sauter has worked in TV for years, including a couple of years as story editor on Moonlighting. His new book is an insider's look at the industry. Also today, Women, Art, and Power. Feminist art historian Linda Nochlin examines the conditions in the art world that have prevented women from being considered great artists. And we have reviews of the new reissue from jazz singer Sheila Jordan and of the new comedy special starring SCTV alum Andrea Martin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Carl Sauter remembers the night he lost control, a night several years before he became a successful TV scriptwriter. He was watching a particularly mindless episode of Three's Company when he screamed at his television, "I can write that junk." And as he sat down at the typewriter, he asked himself, "But is it really so easy to write that badly?" Carl Sauter was one of the lucky ones. He not only broke into TV, he became the story editor of one of TV's best-written, most innovative programs, Moonlighting. In 1986, he won a Writers Guild Award for the episode The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice. That's the one where David and Maddie dream that they're a trumpeter and singer back in the 1940s. In 1988, Sauter won another Writers Guild Award for the episode It's a Wonderful Job. Now he's writing screenplays. Lots of viewers yell at their TVs the same words Sauter once yelled at his. For these hopeful writers, Sauter has written the book How to Sell Your Screenplay, The Real Rules of Film and Television. He also lectures on the same subject at the American Film Institute. Carl Sauter, welcome to Fresh Air.
So the first thing,
thank you for having me
on. The first thing I have to ask you, is it easy to write that badly? What do you think?
No, it's not at all. The number one message I try to give to writers and to viewers is don't be fooled by how bad so much of our film and television is. That's not how people get into the industry. You have to write better than what you see on the screen.
So how come what we see on the screen isn't as good as people are capable of writing?
Because it's such a collaborative process. Every movie you've seen or every television episode goes through a lot of steps before the final product is made. Often there was a good idea or there was even a pretty good script somewhere along the way. But because this is such a collaborative form, it's very hard to keep the sort of essence of a script intact. And what often happens is that they tend to fall apart in every rewrite.
Before we get to talking about your experiences on Moonlighting, I'd like for you to unravel some of the mysteries of television for us and explain some of the things that we see. Most TV shows have certain formulas, and they seem to follow just a certain formula from week to week. The opening's very similar, the closing's very similar. You can predict what the character is going to do. This is intentional, isn't it?
It is. We try not to use the word formula because it implies that, you know, it's, you just cut it out of a cookie cutter every week. But it is an F word. The word is franchise. The principle behind most of our television is that viewer loyalty is very important, and that on every show there are certain givens every week that an audience tunes in to see. For example, if you watch Murder, She Wrote, you expect a crime. You expect, you know, five suspects for it, and you expect that Angela Lansbury will figure out some clever way to solve the mystery. That becomes the franchise of the show. The challenge for a writer is within those limits to be real original and real clever, and that's where our television tends to fall apart.
Do most television shows have Bibles where they spell out what the characteristics are of all the characters on the show?
They're supposed to. It's very helpful if you're a freelance writer coming in to pitch ideas. It's very important to know what you can and can't do with a character, and it's not always apparent just from watching the show. A lot of it's very subtle. I mentioned Murder, She Wrote. On that show, one of the biggest problems they have, for example, is getting Angela Lansbury into the story because they don't want her to be a meddler. So she can't come charging in and say, "I'm going to solve this mystery." She has to be pulled into it. That's why she has all those damn relatives.
That's right. Oh, she sure
they
does.
Need a way. They need a way to get her into the story. That's the kind of background that writers need to have before they try and write for a show.
Why are dramas 1 hour and sitcoms 1 half hour?
It's a great question. Nobody, I think, can really answer it well. There has historically been this belief that you can't be funny for more than half an hour on television. Of course, feature films belie that because, you know, feature films have to be funny for 2 hours. That really has only started to change in the last few years, and Moonlighting was really one of the first shows that sort of crossed the line between comedy and drama in 1 hour. At the time that Moonlighting came on, there was another show called Crazy Like a Fox. And the first time that both shows were eligible for the Emmys, there was enormous brouhaha about what category they were going to be in, because up until then, there had never really been an hour show that had that much comedy in it.
Are there any rules of thumb about the number of laughs per show you're supposed to have if the show is funny?
Yes, in half-hour sitcoms, they call it the rule of three, which it's an informal rule, but not all that informal, that there should be three laughs per page. Now, a page in a situation comedy is about 45 seconds. That's very hard to do, to be funny three times and tell a story.
Well, isn't the rule of three also that you're supposed to build on that one joke two other times?
Yes, and it's interesting. An awful lot of screenwriting comes in threes. Lists are funnier in threes. And yes, in the build on a joke, one of the old comedy principles is that something is funny once, it's even funnier the third time. But it has to keep building. You can't do the same joke over and over. You have to go, you know, good, better, best. And that's the comedy rule of three.
Here's one of the mysteries to me. Why are there still laugh tracks? Everybody's hip to them. Everybody knows that these people laughed years ago and are probably dead now, although their laughter has been recorded. Everybody understands how it's supposed to operate on them. I don't know of anybody who likes laugh tracks. I know they've been eliminated on some shows, yet they're still on lots of others.
They are, and it's real frustrating because it is an artificial device to sort of point out where the jokes are, and I think it really hurts the writing. I've not worked on a show that has a laugh track, so I've actually never had the experience of having people laugh too loudly at something that I wrote. But I think part of it is because a lot of times our television scripts are so bad, people aren't sure which parts were supposed to be funny. And one of the things that a laugh track does is kind of point out, oh, that was funny. I think it's not a good device, and I applaud the move away from it on an awful lot of shows.
I always wonder on the particularly bad episodic TV shows, whether the producers like the show or whether they're very, very cynical people who think, well, I don't like this, but I know those dumb listeners out there will.
Unfortunately, there's an enormous amount of cynicism, and it's a very prestige-oriented industry. So when you work on one of the critically acclaimed shows, you feel better about yourself, you feel better about your writing, you get more reinforcement. I don't think anybody sets out to make a bad television episode or sets out to make a bad movie, and there are just as many bad movies out on a daily basis as there are television shows. What happens is that for whatever reasons, in the process of putting it together, something that could have been good deteriorates. That's the great mystery of this industry. It's very hard to understand how some projects end up being so good and others end up just consistently being so bad.
My guest is Carl Sauter, and he was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first 2 years, and he won 2 Writers Guild Awards for his scripts. He's also the author of the book How to Sell Your Screenplay. Let's talk about your experiences on Moonlighting. Now, you had explained to us what a franchise is, that it's basically the plot rules and the characterization rules for a series. Did Moonlighting have one? You started at the beginning, right?
Yes, I started. I was not there for the first few episodes, but I was a story editor for basically the first season and a half once they knew that Moonlighting was going to go on for a couple of years. And it had some very definite rules. The major one was, and it was great training as a writer, the major one was be very inventive within the limits established by the show. So, for example, in the first season, only had 3 characters to work with, Maddie, David, and then Miss DePesto. Anytime our story started to rely too much on outside characters, Glenn Caron, who created the show, would pull us back from that, saying those guest characters are not what this show is about. We had, talk about the rule of three, we had an informal rule that if you got to a story where you were introducing more than 3 guest characters in a week, we weren't going to be able to spend enough time with Maddie and David, and so we went through and started cutting out the extra characters to get down to the story.
Moonlighting was one of the first shows in what I think is still a trend, and that is that the two main characters have a sexual attraction for each other, but they never consummate it. Now, Maddie and David have since consummated, but...
Yes.
But there was at least a couple of years in which, you know, that was so much of the plot twist every week, was that you could tell they were really interested in each other, but they resisted. Was this a conscious thing in the story?
Oh, very conscious decision.
What was the rationale behind it?
Well, when Glenn first sold the idea for Moonlighting, he sold it as Cheers with Murder. And so it was very much the same sort of ongoing tension between the two main characters as in Cheers. Remington Steele had a very similar sort of setup for mm-hmm. the show. The problem is it's very hard to sustain that. For those people out there who are Cheers fans, and I think it's consistently one of the best written shows on television, they had the same problems Moonlighting did in the second season. They could not decide whether to consummate or not to consummate. Because once you've done that, it's very hard. You can't go back. You've got to find other things to do with the characters. And yet you feel real guilty week to week, sort of teasing the audience. And you fear that people are going to get bored with that. So while it was a very intriguing way to start the show, it's also the thing that a long-term probably most hurt the show because it was unclear where to go with it.
So you'd have philosophical discussions from week to week?
Yes. Yes, in terms of because you feel a great responsibility to an audience. There's enormous loyalty, and when you're on a hit show like Moonlighting, you really hear from people a lot. I mean, you get everything we did. I mean, good or bad. I mean, it felt like we knew about it very quickly from the people who watched the show. I had left, but in the infamous episode where Maddie got married, I mean, they literally knew within 24 hours of that episode that in terms of its public support, it had been a disastrous decision to make. And the next day after it aired, they started the process of untangling it.
That's right. Another innovation of Moonlighting was that Maddie and David, and this is, of course, the Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis character, they address the audience and acknowledge that they're characters in a television program. Whose idea was it to do that?
That was Glenn Caron's idea, and it came about not out of any brilliant creative decision. It came about because it was a gigantic hole in the plot of the first episode where it was done, and we didn't know what to do. We were always way behind. We did not have time to rewrite the script or refilm things, and Glenn said, we're just going to have David turn to the audience and say something, and people will be so stunned they'll never notice that there was this gigantic hole in the plot. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. And that then became part of the franchise for the show, that once or twice every episode, usually David would turn to the camera and sort of acknowledge that he was in a television show.
Was it a plot hole that you were responsible for?
Well, it was kind of a group plot hole. As I remember, it was an episode in which we were never really decided if a particular character got killed or not.
This could be a problem.
It could be a problem. But interesting, you know, we got all this incredible fan mail and all these phone calls about how brilliant it was that David turned to the camera. We never got a letter about that huge hole in the plot. So it was a very interesting lesson in sort of diverting an audience's attention.
Well, I think it's very rare that a producer of a television show will suggest that you do something as unusual and innovative as that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great treats of working on Moonlighting was that originality got rewarded. We used to sit in our story meetings and Glenn would say, you know, I don't want sixes. I don't want, you know, mediocre ideas. I want tens. You know, give me things that are really inventive and really different. The one way that you will not fail on the show is by taking risks. And that was a wonderful attitude to sort of, you know, cut my teeth on in television.
How close to deadline were your scripts written?
After. I mean, we were literally writing scripts at some points that where they were shooting. I wrote on Moonlighting with a terrific partner, a woman named Deborah Frank, and in one famous episode, we were sitting at the typewriter writing the scene, and Glenn came rushing into the room and said, we've run out of material on the set, give me that, and halfway through the scene, he just pulled it out of the typewriter and himself ran it down to deliver to the set. You really can't cut it any closer than that.
Is this one of the reasons why Moonlighting ended up having so many reruns?
Exactly. Because we tended to be so far behind on the scripts, we just could not get them done in time to do new episodes. Just to shoot an episode takes 7 working days. So, you know, you cannot, in our television, not to mention the editing and the casting and all the mechanics that go into every hour of television. So what happened was, as soon as we fell behind on the scripts, we could just never catch up. And every year the show worked real hard to try and, you know, do it right from the beginning. But there's a real tendency in television, because it's such a pressure cooker, to fall behind. And Moonlighting was as bad at that as anyone. It may, though, be a victim of a larger problem in our television, which is whenever we buy a series, we buy it for 5 years. It's very hard to sustain the quality of a show over that length of time. That's why most of what you see tends to fall apart in the second or third year. Moonlighting is a good example of a show that probably would have benefited from how the Europeans do television, which is they buy a particular number of episodes and that's it. And Moonlighting probably would have been a terrific show for a year or 2 years. But, you know, our system, unfortunately, is always looking for the long-running show.
I want to talk with you more about your experiences writing for television. We'll also get to some of your experiences writing now for film. But first, we'll take a short break. My guest is Carl Sauter. He's the author of the new book, How to Sell Your Screenplay, and the former story editor for Moonlighting. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Carl Sauter is my guest. He was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first 2 years, and 2 of his episodes won Writers Guild Awards for Best TV Drama. Sauter also lectures on how to write screenplays and sell them, and he's written a book called How to Sell Your Screenplay. Let's talk about one of the episodes that won a Writers Guild Award, and I'm thinking of the black and white episode, The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice, and part of this is set in a 1940s nightclub where Maddie's a singer and David is a trumpeter. Was this your idea to do this kind of a dream flashback?
It was actually
homage type of thing.
I mentioned my partner on Moonlighting, Deborah Franken. It was actually her idea, and it was an idea that she had pitched to other shows, and people looked at her like she was mad. And our very first meeting with Moonlighting, I just thought it was a great idea. And we went in and pitched it to Glenn, and he went nuts over it. And that actually is the episode that got us our very first job with Moonlighting.
How did you pitch the episode?
We pitched it very simply. A lot of what I try and do in the book is talk about the real way that it works. When you watch bad film or television, people get fooled. They think that complicated plots and lots of elaborate effects are really what screenwriting is about, and that's not true. Good screenwriting is good storytelling, and in the case of that episode, the story that we told was very simple. We wanted Maddie and David to get preoccupied with a murder that happened in the 40s, and then in separate dreams, become the characters as a way to act out the tension in their relationship set in the 40s. It was really pitched that simply and that directly. We talked about the possibility of doing it in black and white, which Glenn was a huge fan of that notion. He also very much liked the idea that both Bruce and Sybil would get a chance to be involved in music. So it was an idea that just sold immediately as soon as we started talking about it.
Now, you were story editor for 2 years on Moonlighting. What does that mean exactly?
Well, a story editor is a staff writer. It's one of the things you try and do if you write television, because it's very hard to sustain a career as a freelancer. Freelancers move around from one show to another. And being staff on a show means that you have a steady income and you're very much involved in the whole process of a show. Basically, what a story editor does is meet with writers, look at writing samples, sit in on sessions where writers come in and pitch their ideas, and also rewrite scripts. We would often work with scripts that other writers had done, and we would redo the scenes or redo the dialogue to try and improve it.
You have heard, I'm sure, lots of people pitch story ideas, and I think that's probably taught you about the mistakes people make and the wrong ideas that they have about how television gets made.
When you were doing moonlighting, what were some of the most commonly pitched ideas?
We had a list. I was astounded because I had never sat on that side of the process before, where you met with writers all day long and heard their ideas. And the first message that comes across is people are incredibly unoriginal. You are thrilled when a writer comes in and tells you a story you haven't heard before. For people who are interested in this as a possible career, the first advice that I give is to don't sit down and come up with movie ideas, and don't sit down and come up with TV ideas. If we've seen it 100 times in film and television, it is no longer a good idea. It's not an original idea. The stories that were most often pitched at Moonlighting were Maddie and David are trapped, you know, in an elevator shaft, on a boat, in the Xerox room, you know, in a mountain cabin. And every writer would talk about this idea like it was the most amazing original story we'd ever heard. So much so that we finally started to say to writers before they came in, please don't pitch Maddie and David are trapped. The problem with that as a story idea is that it can't go anywhere. Maddie and David are trapped, they fight, they make up, they fight, they get out. There's no surprises in the story, which means that it's a story that's not well structured for film or television.
Have you had to deal with standards and practices a lot? Did you have things that were changed at the suggestion of the networks?
Yeah, very much so, particularly on Moonlighting, because one of the great joys for Moonlighting was to see how far we could stretch the rules. And one of the advantages of doing scripts at the last minute is often the network didn't have time to get the jokes before they were on the air, whereas if we had given them the scripts a month ahead of time, they may have kind of finally figured out, gee, that's a pretty dirty joke, and we're not going to let that on. That whole process in the industry has really changed dramatically, and just in the last few years, it used to be when you did a script, you got back notes on all your lines, and they would trade two dams for a hell and all of that. That whole process has gotten much more liberal, and there are really only a very few things you can't do on television now.
What are they?
So, a couple of those four-letter words haven't quite crossed over, though. I mean, I was astounded. Just this year, if you look at some of the words like bitch that are now common in most screenplays, even 2 or 3 years ago, you could not put that into a script. So I think the audience can guess the couple that haven't made it onto the list yet.
You reprint some of the notes that Standards and Practices sent down to the writers of Soap. And Soap was a sitcom a few years ago with Billy Crystal in it. And it was one of the first sitcoms to have a recurring gay character on it. And these are pretty interesting. I'm just going to read a couple of the notes that were sent back. Delete the word slut. Delete the word fruitcake. Please ensure that Benson's self-effacing portrayal is always played tongue-in-cheek and that he continues to stay one-up vis-a-vis his antagonists. In order to be able to treat the mafia storyline here and throughout, it will be necessary to introduce a principal, continuing character of Italian descent who is very positive and who will, through the dialogue and action, balance and counter any negative stereotypes. And then in order to treat Jody as a gay character, his portrayal must at all times be handled without limp-wristed actions or other negative stereotyping. You know, a few of the notes in here are about objectionable language, but most of the notes in here are about stereotypes and how they fear they might be offending a segment of the community that would be viewing.
Very much so. You make a great point, because there is another side to Standards and Practices, which is to try and not promote stereotypes and cliches. A lot of what Soap did, of course, was make fun of the whole form of the soap opera. And so the soap opera has had a tendency to have cliched characters, and as a result, Soap sometimes lapsed into making what in the network's eyes constituted making too much fun of those characters. So that's a fairly responsible side of the industry. The problem you have as a writer is sometimes the anti-clichés become the clichés, if
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, the super black character, the black mom who does everything, you know, those. In this day and age, you have to be very careful as a writer to offer real characters as opposed to clichés one way or the other.
You were so anxious to break into television. It seems to me shortly after you got in, you got out.
I know. I'm a shallow kind of guy. What can I say? Television was very hard. The being on staff for me was just an incredible grind. I had a whole nother career that I talk about in the book, and that I was in, of all things, government for 15 years. And I had been on Moonlighting for a week, my first staff job, and I walked into the executive producer's office and I said, this is why I left government. All I do is have meetings, deal with politics, you know. I, you know, I left working in government so I would never have to talk to the city council again. And here I am, in effect, talking to a city council, pitching story ideas. It's the same process. I was astounded. The reason that I became a writer was to write and to have more time by myself. And what I found being on staff on a show was it was exactly the same process I had been through in the city of Pasadena. I also, Deborah and I, were very lucky because it's very hard to move from television into feature films, and we started getting feature film offers early on in the process at Moonlighting, and it was a step that I really wanted to make, and so we finally decided to leave the show to do that.
Now, one of your screenwriting credits, although it wasn't credited on the screen, is you did one of the rewrites for My Stepmother is an Alien.
I was one of 12 writers on that poor film, and Deborah and I did. We were right in the middle of it. What people often don't realize is that there are lots and lots of writers whose names you'll never see, who somewhere along the way in the process of a movie either did a draft or were involved. That film was a classic example of something I was saying at the beginning, of a movie that sort of fell apart along the way. The version of the script that we were handed was a pretty terrific script with a lot of substance to it. It had very little to do with the movie that they ultimately made. So for writers who think, oh, I could write My Stepmother as an Alien, the part of the process they don't see is that they would have to write a better script than that to get into the industry.
It seems like it would be a whole lot more direct to just write bad scripts and sell them.
Well,
rather
think
than writing
it
good ones
be.
And then water them down.
And unfortunately, that's one of the hardest messages to get out to writers. It was one of the hardest things for me to learn. It took me 6 years of working very hard to get into this industry. One of the biggest mistakes I was making along the way is that I was writing at the level of what I saw, not understanding that you have to write better than that to get into the industry. Most of the episodes that are on most television series, if they had been submitted as writing samples, those writers probably would never have gotten in the door. The sort of rule of thumb is that a lot of good scripts in this industry don't get made, but good writers always get noticed because there just are not that many of them.
Do you think that television is on the whole getting any better or getting any worse?
I think I have to say it's getting better. I think if you look at the schedule now versus the schedule of 10 years ago, there is more variety, there are more interesting kinds of shows. It's a hard medium to improve quickly. It tends to, the progress in television tends to be measured by little bits here and there. There was no such thing as a Wonder Years even 4 years ago. There was no such thing as an L.A. Law 10 years ago, pre-Hill Street Blues. So that I think that there's a lot of good news happening on television. I feel the same way about feature films. I look at the last year's crop of films, and for the first time, I think films began to skew more to an adult audience. So I'm generally pretty upbeat about that you're going to increasingly see improvements in the quality.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you a lot for telling us about writing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Carl Sauter is the author of How to Sell Your Screenplay, The Real Rules of Film and Television. It's published by New Chapter Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with noted child psychiatrist Dr. Robert Coles. He's the author of over 40 books, including a Pulitzer Prize-winning series on children in crisis. He's also written several biographies, including books on Dorothy Day, William Carlos Williams, and Eric Erickson. Coles' latest book, The Call of Stories, tells how he uses literature and personal narrative in his teaching of psychiatry. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? That's the title of a 1971 essay by Linda Nochlin. She's one of the first feminist art historians. Coming up, Linda Nochlin discusses women, art, and power. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of an album of duets with singer Sheila Jordan and bassist Harvey Swartz. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Andrea Martin Together Again. It's her Showtime cable special featuring guest appearances by her fellow SCTV veterans Catherine O'Hara, Dave Thomas, and Martin Short. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Supreme Court today upheld the death penalty for convicted killers who are retarded or underage, as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
By a 5-4 vote, the High Court ruled that executing 16 and 17-year-olds, or executing the retarded, does not amount to unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. All three cases before the court involved brutal murders. In the two cases involving juveniles, Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the court majority, began by noting that at the time the Constitution was adopted, 14-year-olds were sentenced to death. In deciding whether the death penalty for 16 and 17-year-olds violates standards, he said, we must look not to our own standards of decency, but to the laws passed by the state legislatures. And a majority of the state legislatures that do have the death penalty, he said, now authorize it for 16 and 17-year-olds. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
In another decision, the court today refused to restrict huge punitive damage awards often imposed by juries to punish companies for gross negligence. But the court suggested that it might be inclined to return to the issue later, as NPR's John Idstey reports.
In a 7-2 decision, the court upheld the award of $6 million in punitive damages to a small Vermont trash disposal company, Calco Industries. Calco had sued a large multinational waste disposal company named Browning Ferris Industries for trying to put it out of business illegally. Browning Ferris argued that the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution protected it from excessive fines, but the court said that excessive fines clause applied only to government fines, not to disputes between private parties. But the court left open the door, suggesting a case might be brought on other grounds, specifically the due process clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Business would argue in such a case that its right to a fair trial is denied because juries are given no guidelines on the appropriate size of punitive damage awards. Consumer groups say the large punitive damage awards are needed to deter business wrongdoing. Business says the fines deter product development. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The long-awaited report on Pete Rose's alleged gambling activities was made public today. The report by baseball investigator John Dowd covers a 3-year period beginning in 1985. Dowd says at one point the Cincinnati Reds manager bet $2,000 per game on baseball. Pete Rose is labeling the report 225 pages of ugly hearsay. Hamilton County Judge Norbert Nadel released the report under pressure from the Ohio Supreme Court. Yesterday, Nadel ordered a delay in a hearing on the charges against Rose before Baseball Commissioner Bart Giamatti. Major League lawyers today appealed Nadel's decision. Jury selection began today in the $4 million tax evasion trial of Leona Helmsley. Her attorney is arguing that publicity is hurting his case. His bid to get the trial moved to Philadelphia was turned down. The Helmsleys are charged with evading taxes by charging millions of dollars in renovations and furnishings at their 28-room mansion in Connecticut to their hotel and real estate companies. The trial on the 47-count indictment comes without her real estate magnate husband at her side. Harry Helmsley, who's 80 years old, was also named in the case, but has suffered a series of small strokes causing memory impairment, and he was severed from the case. Tropical storm Allison made landfall today south of Houston, Texas, with torrential rains and 65-mile-an-hour winds. A tugboat was capsized, a barge driven aground, and roofs were damaged. It's the first tropical storm of the Atlantic hurricane season. The National Hurricane Center says tropical storm force winds are extending about 150 miles to the east of the storm center. On Wall Street today, stock prices were sharply lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 20 points to close at 2511.38. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 144 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When singers first became prominent in jazz, they appeared in front of big bands. Later, they began performing with smaller groups or just a pianist. But jazz singer Sheila Jordan has pared down her backing even further to the four strings of Harvey Swartz's upright bass. Their 1982 album, Old Time Feeling, has just been reissued, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Swing, 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 everybody start to swing. Hi, hi, ho, ho, now you're swinging with a swing.
Sheila Jordan first performed with only a bass player for company in the early 1960s. But it wasn't until 1977 that she recorded in this duo format, and it wasn't until a few years later that she found her ideal accompanist in bassist Harvey Swartz. Swartz is ideal because he responds instantly to the singer's darting moves, and because he's so at ease with his instrument. With Jordan, he's a proverbial one-man band, using his bass as everything from a singing horn to a music box to a bongo. But he never forgets the bass player's responsibility to keep time and outline the harmony. Swartz's orchestral approach keeps the format from sounding like a gimmick.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses I sprinkle with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky?
Sheila Jordan and Harvey Swartz have been working together off and on throughout the 80s. But so far, they've only had one album out in the States, the 1982 recording, Old Time Feeling. It had gone out of print, but has just been reissued on the Muse label.
Nothing's ever simple, and times are kind of tough. The things I really love, I just don't seem to get enough. I miss that old time feeling much more than I can say. The joy in my heart has gone away.
Sheila Jordan's music has always been peppered with autobiographical references. The recording that put her on the map in 1962 was bandleader George Russell's rearrangement of a tune she'd sung as a kid in Pennsylvania coal country, You Are My Sunshine. For the duo album, she set lyrics to a bebop tune, Quasimodo, by her idol and inspiration, Charlie Parker. When Jordan was a teenager in Detroit, she'd sneak into bars to hear Bird play.
At times I wonder where my life would be if I'd never heard the music of Bird back when I was just a kid. I listened to his precious note floating out of his horn so many years ago. What a treat it used to be for me to hear him, the thrill of being near him. I lived for every song that he played from his heart. Bird brought a special world to me, and by leading the way, I've learned to live my life from the dues that he paid. He turned me on to sounds I never heard before by putting all those magical tones into every single phrase. Somehow I find it rather strange knowing that there are those of us who really love him, while so many aren't even aware of his name. I feel blessed that I grew up spending all of those wonderful years surrounded by the joy that he gave. There's nothing in life that will ever have the meaning for me or can give me the thrill like hearing Charlie Parker. Yeah, baba, baby, you just did it.
Charlie Parker's complex bop left an obvious mark on Jordan's scat singing, but often her scat has a childlike unself-consciousness too. And on the song Whose Little Angry Man Are You from the musical Raisin, she seems to draw on the sound or spirit of Native American chanting.
Yeah,
That sort of abandon can be risky, and there are times when Jordan gets so caught up in a song, she almost goes right over the edge. But that's one of the things I like about her. She doesn't have the smug composure of a supper club singer, so even when she gets low down and smoky, you know you're not listening to a lounge act. By the way, longtime Jordan fans will be glad to hear that her elusive early 60s album for Blue Note, Portrait of Sheila, is supposed to be reissued soon on CD. These reissues are good news, but since Jordan at age 60 is singing better than ever, and since she hasn't recorded an album in this country in over 4 years, what we really need are some new Sheila Jordan records.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Old Time Feeling is on the Muse record label.
You never know, dear, how much I want you. Oh, please don't take
This is Fresh Air. Feminist art historian Linda Nochlin has collected her essays from the past 17 years in a new book called Women, Art, and Power, and Other Essays. In 1971, Nochlin wrote a landmark essay that set out to answer a troubling question: why have there been no great women artists? Nochlin said that in approaching the question, the first impulse of feminists was to try to dig up lost, unappreciated women artists and make a case for their importance. But Nochlin decided that it was the wrong impulse.
Yeah, which does not mean by any means that I am not interested in women artists, both in their production, in their practice, in their relationship to wider issues of art history, their relationship to gender issues, issues raised by literary criticism, etc. I'm extremely interested in women artists. What I'm really not interested in is simply expanding the canon of greatness by adding a few women artists as sort of exceptions to that canon. I'm interested in questioning the whole production of greatness and the whole mythology of artistic genius as something uncaused, something that's innate, that will out no matter what the odds. And I want to put that all into a much larger social framework and examine not just why are there no great women artists, but why are there great men artists? That's another question, which I think comes up with that, right?
So you're looking at the nature of the art world and the art world's institutions to see why men have become great artists and why so few women have been able to rise in the art world.
Right, exactly.
What are some of the circumstances historically that have conspired to keep women out of the art world?
Well, the whole positioning of women generally as people relatively without power, not professional and so on, but then quite specifically in terms of the practice of art institutions, women were not allowed to enter the great art academies at a time when that kind of professional training was an absolute must as far as getting ahead in the field of art was concerned. A very specific detail, women were not allowed to learn how to draw from the nude model when that was sort of the whole basis of high art during the Renaissance and the 17th century, indeed, right down through the 19th century. For various kinds of reasons having to do with modesty and inappropriateness and so on, women were not allowed to do that. So they never, if you can't paint from the nude model, you can't do the Sistine ceiling. That's pretty clear.
Another question that interests you is if women react differently to paintings than men. And I think this is an especially important question when you're dealing with the subjects of nudes and erotic painting. Mm-hmm. You've said erotic means erotic to men.
Yeah.
In painting, because it's men who did most of the paintings that we know and men who decided to purchase them.
Right. And I think...
Oh, and men who canonized them.
Exactly. But I think in this respect that I've found a lot of help in modern feminist psychoanalytic theory, the whole theory of the gaze as power, including...
This is G-A-Z-E.
Yeah. Who is looking? Whose eye is it that's supposed to be fixing the object in the painting? Whose pleasure is it that incites the representation of the nude? Obviously, it's going to be different for the woman viewer, according to psychoanalytic theory, and even according to just sort of common sense, then it's going to be for the male artist or the male viewer. What is a woman's relationship, say, to the nude? If a woman is either a viewer or a painter, how does she react to the female nude?
Is there an example of a painting or a show that you can give us where you found yourself having a really different reaction to erotic subject matter or to nudes than male colleagues of yours did?
Yeah, I would say the Balthus show would be a very good case in point because it's pretty obvious. Balthus was associated with the Surrealists. I think he did some very interesting early work, and then he went on to do these sort of perverse Lolitas, either semi-nude, very young adolescent girls, or young girls raising their legs so that you could see their underwear or their lack of it, and so on. And this was a show at the Met about 5 years ago. And I called it into question, not because it was, quote, erotic, but I just wanted to ask questions like, for whom is this erotic? Why are women told that if they question this kind of representation as erotic, that they're naive or don't know anything about art or are against pleasure or against sex or so on, rather than saying, well, for whom is this erotic? Who is it? Whose erotic desire is this constructed for? What do women have to do to participate in this erotic? I mean, do they have to be masochistic? What kinds of operations, in a way, does the woman spectator have to perform in order to participate in this so-called construction of the erotic?
In raising questions about how the female body has been represented in art, you did a takeoff of an anonymous 19th century photograph. And this photograph was of a naked woman offering a tray of apples. Mm-hmm. Now, hanging on this tray were also her nude breasts, which were basically being offered as two other delectable fruits. Describe what your takeoff of this was and why you did it.
Well, what I wanted to show was that erotic metaphors, visual erotic metaphors, are not reversible. What works in the feminine, I mean, that apples breasts analogy is part of high art. Gauguin does it. He shows women displaying fruit and nude breasts on a tray. I mean, this is something that is mobile. It goes from low art to high art. When you try to reverse it, as I tried to do, I took a photograph of our studio model called By My Bananas, and I made him pose wearing heavy wool socks and boots, just like the woman was wearing black stockings and cute little high heels. And I brought him a tray of bananas, and I showed him where to hold it. And he got the point right away. I mean, he was a very good model. It's the only photograph I've ever really taken. It's not just a family snapshot. And boy, oh boy, this made the point right away, because he didn't look delectable. He looked ridiculous. I mean, he just looked hysterically funny. And the whole point, it was part of a lecture where I was pointing out that, you know, those who have no turf have no language. I mean, if you don't have an erotic territory, so to speak, you can't just reverse things and say that's equal. It's not.
One last question. Do you think that feminist art criticism is accepted now in the art world?
By some people, yes. But there's also a lot of antagonism, too. I would be fooling myself if I thought that there wasn't. People feel incredibly threatened. And for a lot of interesting reasons, I would say that in history and in lit crit, there's a lot more acceptance of feminist work, gender studies, and so on. Art history and art criticism often tend to be very recalcitrant because we are related to objects, and objects have value, and objects hang in museums, and objects require connoisseurship, and the kinds of questions that feminists and social historians are asking tend to lead away from objects and their values, from the art historian or critic as a kind of value ordainer for wealthy collectors or museums or people who see art as objects of supreme value. And I think we are dangerous. We undermine that whole structure.
Linda Nochlin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Nochlin is a distinguished professor of art history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Her new book, Women, Art, and Power, and Other Essays, is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, a review of the changing leadership in China. Jiang Zemin is now the Communist Party leader there, and generally the men moving up within the party are more conservative. No surprise, really. A report from NPR's Frank Browning on the impact of AIDS on the health insurance industry around the country. Americans with AIDS are having their medical insurance canceled, and many others are being denied coverage. And this question, it may be a rhetorical one. How do you put a dollar value on a bald eagle or the sea otters killed by the Exxon oil spill in Alaska? And the career of James Jamerson is reviewed musically. He was the bass player on most of the Motown hits of the 60s.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Andrea Martin's comic impersonations were always a highlight of the SCTV comedy series. This Saturday night, Showtime will air her first cable comedy special, Andrea Martin Together Again. It reunites Martin with SCTV alums like Martin Short and Catherine O'Hara. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Hello, I'm Edna Boyle of Texan Edna Boyle's Organ Emporium. But as you can see, we've branched out. That's right. Tex and I are now the proud owners of the Boyle Hotel and Rejuvenation Spa. Isn't that right, Tex?
That's right, Edna.
And Tex and I have never been happier. We're located...
Back when she was one of the stars of Second City TV, Andrea Martin did the sort of stuff Tracy Ullman is famous for doing now. Comic characters that are so outrageous and so dissimilar that the only thing they have in common is the woman who portrays them. The accents and looks are so different that Martin, Ullman and SCTV veteran Catherine O'Hara, could almost be considered the Meryl Streeps of comedy. The Showtime TV special Andrea Martin Together Again reunites Martin with O'Hara and with two other SCTV graduates. It also reunites viewers with some of Martin's most memorable comic characters from that series. The premise of Andrea Martin Together Again is that Martin, after a year's convalescence following a nervous breakdown, is hosting a live TV comeback show. Hence the title, Together Again. New characters are introduced, old ones are updated, and there's even a flashback sequence that sheds new light on Edith Prickly's younger days. Specifically, it suggests that she had an affair with a politician whose face is never shown, but whose voice is strangely familiar.
The year was 1960. I was in love with the man of my dreams.
Now, Edith,
I've had more fun with you in the last couple of months than a barrel of monkeys. But I think now, the discretion being the better part of valor, I must end this sordid affair.
Now, knowing the history of these characters, the Prickleys, that is, not the Kennedys, is at least half the fun. So if you didn't watch SCTV the first time around, or haven't caught the show in reruns on Nickelodeon's Nick at Night, some of this stuff is bound to seem a little strange and disconnected. But other portions of Andrea Martin together again hold up fine on their own. The best segment of this show within a show has Martin poking fun at Paul Simon's Graceland tour by performing a song while backed by South African singers.
Hello. And the message that I learned there underneath the incense tree was it? I didn't even have to go to Africa. Could have stayed right where I've been. Oh, Africa, Africa. It was a marvelous 2 weeks. And then, hello, hi, how are you? That I visit ye, I'll bring my own inner peace.
In other skits, Martin Short guest stars as Dr. August Allwoman, a combination therapist and fitness instructor. He's not funny at all. But Catherine O'Hara, who appears as several characters in a film about friendship, sure is. She and Martin play several pairs of best friends in a segment that savagely ridicules Oprah Winfrey's recent Just Between Friends TV special.
Jane is so vibrant.
Oh, Sue is fun and funny.
Jane is sexy and sensual and seriously smart.
Sue can do anything.
All right, like you're not one of the most thoughtful, most considerate people I've ever met.
Oh, Sue always puts others before herself. She listens to you and she never judges you.
Oh, Jane, you are so beautiful.
Oh, get out of here. You are.
You are, Jane.
You are.
With everything added up, Andrea Martin Together Again ranks as an average episode of SCTV. That still means it's better than most comedy on TV and a lot more unusual. Where else can you see and hear a woman play Scott Joplin on the harp? Badly.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Korean writer An Chung-yo has translated many of this country's most famous books into Korean, and he's translated many Korean books into English. On the next edition of Fresh Air, An talks about his own book, a semi-autobiographical novel about the Korean troops that fought in the Vietnam War. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Lee Dorsey, the New Orleans singer who had the hits Working in a Coal Mine and Ya Ya. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Nobel Prize-winning writer Günter Grass. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Liz Trubert and Hilary Goldhammer. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.